Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Lonnie Watson. Lonnie is research fellow and associate faculty in the philosophy faculty at the University of Oxford. Her research specializations include epistemology, social epistemology, virtue theory, and the theory of rights. Her new book has just been published with Routledge. It is titled The Right to Know: Epistemic Rights and Why We Need Them. Now, we often talk as if individuals have entitlements to certain kinds of information, like medical test results, the voting records of their political representatives, for example, maybe crime statistics in the neighborhood that they live in, and the like. We also talk as if these entitlements entail duties on the part of others to provide the relevant information. And furthermore, we often talk as if the individual's entitlement to these sorts of information or this kind of information also entails a range of protections for individuals against manipulation or misinformation, deception, and the like. Now, despite the fact that these ideas are kind of commonplace, there's surprisingly little in the philosophical literature about the nature and the contours of these relevant entitlements. Lonnie Watson seeks to remedy this. In her new book, The Right to Know, she develops a conception of epistemic rights. These are a distinct class of entitlements which nonetheless fit neatly into the existing landscape of rights theory. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about, but why don't we begin, as we normally do, with our guest. Hi, Lonnie.
Hi, Bob. I'm very well, thank you, and really delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. You know, we usually start these interviews off with the author saying a few things about themselves. Why don't we not break that trend? Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So you can tell from the accent, I'm a Brit. I'm from the south coast of England, from Southampton. I've lived in a few different places in the UK. I've spent a bit of time in the US. I've lived mostly in Edinburgh for the past 10 years. Which is where I am just now on a beautiful, sunny, warm day. But I'm actually based at the moment at the University of Oxford as of last year, like you said. So, I'm very much an epistemologist. And I work, as you said, in the areas of sort of social, political, and virtue epistemology and in the rights theory literature. And I think really I'm an epistemologist because, as it turns out, I'm just very interested in the epistemic dimension of our lives, really. I usually introduce myself and my research by saying that it's all about questions and questioning, because I'm fascinated by questions. And I think the underlying reason for that fascination is because of the important and central role that I think questions play in our everyday epistemic interactions and exchanges, but times when we're, you know, giving each other information or trying to acquire information that we wouldn't otherwise have. So questions are, I think, one of, if not the most important epistemic tool that we have, because they allow us to get at information and knowledge that we might not otherwise have. They give us a kind of epistemic autonomy and power. So really, I'm just very interested in and concerned with how we can work with each other in our epistemic communities and flourish within our epistemic environments. So I think the epistemic is really a vital component in all of these different settings that we find ourselves in public and in private life. And I'm really passionate about and just dedicated to trying to protect it. Like I say, I think my work in the field of social, political and virtue epistemology is, I think, part of perhaps a somewhat newer wave of epistemology, which has emerged over maybe the past 30 to 40 years. These are the areas of epistemology that I think have basically interested in connecting the abstract concepts that we talk about, knowledge and information and understanding, to the situations that we actually encounter them in our lives. And that's the version of epistemology that I identify with and I'm passionate about. And that's really why I am an epistemologist, why I continue in the profession. I didn't actually study epistemology as an undergraduate, and I think if I had, I might have been put off for life. But but this is the version of epistemology that we have on the scene now, and it's just a very different picture, I think, from what it was even 15 years ago. So the book is essentially my attempt to paint something new and interesting into that picture.
Well, that's fabulous. You know, just as a, I guess a, I don't know if I count as an old timer in the profession, but maybe I'm getting close to it. You know, it was one of the real, maybe disorientation is too strong, but one of the sort of disorienting things about my own time as a graduate student was, you know, having come at some topics in epistemology by way of pragmatism, to get to graduate school and find out that epistemology at the time, at least, was about, you know, fake barn facades and red balls at the end of hallways, and, you know, where you had to do a lot of work, sometimes overcome a lot of obstacles even to get at the normative issues that were somewhere hidden, embedded in, you know, some of the examples or whatever. It was very puzzling to me. I was like, I thought epistemology was about a kind of conduct, and our relations to others and all the rest. And this is all about, you know, Jones having a $5 bill in his pocket. And so I thought the whole thing was very puzzling. But so good to see that things
are... Well, thank goodness you persevered. Yeah. I'm just grateful, because that's why epistemology is what it now is, which is, yeah, where I love to be and love to think.
Well, that's fabulous. So why don't we begin talking about the book, which is really fabulous. I recommend it to anybody who's listening to the podcast. It's really sharp and clear and precise, and it's got a lot of virtues. But why don't we begin at the very beginning, which is the introduction, where I think you do a very nice job of setting up some of the stakes, we might think, of the issues that you're interested in. You lay out a very vivid real world example that you return to, you know, various important junctures throughout the book. This has to do with Purdue Pharma and OxyContin. Can you tell us a little bit about that case and how it sort of animates the project and the analysis?
Yeah, sure. And thanks for the kind words on the book. I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
Sure.
So yeah, the central case that I set up in the introduction, and I draw on throughout the book alongside a bunch of other cases, but this is really the one I keep coming back to, is, like you say, the case of the pharmaceutical giant Purdue Pharma in the context of the US opioid crisis. And I think the case in and of itself provides ample illustration of the very real and very significant harms caused by epistemic rights violations. So to give you a sense of the case, in May 2007, Purdue Frederick Company, Inc., an affiliate of Purdue Pharma, along with three of the top executives, were ordered to pay fines totaling $634 million after pleading guilty to criminal charges of misbranding in relation to the opioid-based painkiller OxyContin. So among other things, the company falsely claimed that OxyContin was less addictive than other opioids and less subject to abuse. And Purdue Pharma, for context, is owned by the controversial Sackler family. So in its aggressive marketing of OxyContin, Purdue made liberal use of fabricated information about the addictive properties of the painkiller and repeatedly issued false claims about the effectiveness of the drug, the likelihood of harmful withdrawal symptoms, and the potential for abuse. Purdue armed its sizable sales force with kinds of graphics and charts and all sorts of information, which downplayed the addictive properties of OxyContin. And they even trained salespersons to respond to concerns by medical professionals or others by conveying the false message that the risk of addiction was less than 1% from the drug. So through its aggressive marketing of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma essentially controlled the extensive and systematic spread of false and misleading information throughout the US medical community for the purpose of profit. So in the 2007 trial, the company executives were forced to admit that Purdue had marketed OxyContin, and this is a quote, with the intent to defraud or mislead. And I've got a quote from the US attorney, a statement, John Brownlee, which I think kind of sums up the end of that case quite well. He said, even in the face of warnings from healthcare professionals, the media, and members of its own sales force that OxyContin was being widely abused and causing harm to our citizens, Purdue, under the leadership of its top executives, continued to push a fraudulent marketing campaign. In the process, scores died as a result of OxyContin abuse, and an even greater number of people became addicted to OxyContin, a drug that Purdue led many to believe was safer, less abusable, and less addictive than other pain medications on the market. So you can see the deliberate spread of false and misleading information is basically central to the Purdue Pharma case. And in my approximation, it amounts to a serious and harmful violation of epistemic rights, including the epistemic rights of many of the medical professionals targeted by Purdue and those rights of the patients that they serve. So like I say, that's kind of the central case. It's one of many discussed in the book, but I think it gives a really vivid picture of just how kind of close the relationship is between epistemic rights violations and very real, very serious, widespread and systematic harms.
Right. Fabulous. Can I just ask a quick question about the case? Mm. I think I know the answer is just going to be both. Right? But one of the things that, you know, really the case, as you lay it out in the book and as you've just described it so nicely, got me thinking about, you know, sort of there are two parties that are being defrauded, one fairly directly and one indirectly. And the public is the indirect. The more directly defrauded are the people who are prescribing this stuff. Right. And it seemed to me that the indirectly defrauded are the ones who are being harmed the most. So I thought that was an interesting feature of the case, that the victims are the ones who are sort of one step removed in the causal chain from the actual act of fraud. Does that seem right?
Yeah, that's interesting observation. I think, in one sense, that's right. And there's an interesting question, which I think, you know, maybe we'll circle back to around why that is. And I think that's got a lot to do with authority, epistemic authority, and where that comes from. And sort of almost by taking it two steps through a doctor to a patient, you almost accrue greater epistemic authority, and therefore the kind of opportunity to kind of do more widespread harm is potentially greater. On the other hand, the marketing campaign sort of was really extensive for OxyContin. I mean, probably people will remember it or know what I'm talking about, but, mm-hmm. you know, really, you know, well funded advertisements in, you know, on the telly and in, you know, public magazines and so on that were promoting OxyContin directly to right. The public and to people who might be suffering from pain. So in a sense, it was sort of using those channels of the media and through, you know, very deliberate press releases that were going to doctors, but were also just intended for the, you know, consumption of the public at large. That was a part of the campaigning, I suppose, was directed at the public right. itself. Yeah.
Right. You know, in the States, you know, there are some places in the world that have the good sense to regulate this sort of thing. But in the States, you know, there's the way on that television includes advertisements for drugs that always end with the ask your doctor about that.
Yeah,
which is just, you know, it's clear in the context that it ask your doctor is really a legally safe way of saying tell your doctor you want this thing.
Yeah.
Which so the case is really interesting for all those reasons. Good. So I take it that just to now get into the analysis.
Sure.
I take it that it's important for the view that you defend that epistemic rights, although they are a distinctive kind of entitlement, but you still want to show, and this seems to me to be well-motivated, that epistemic rights sort of fit into the familiar categories and taxonomies of rights theory. Now, people who are listening, who are familiar with the work on rights. I suppose this is still the case that Hofeld is still the touchstone. And if you want a legal thinker and a philosopher who's really into taxonomizing things, this is the guy to look at. So can you tell us a bit about what epistemic rights are and also what makes a right an epistemic right?
Yeah, great. So put simply, epistemic rights are rights concerning epistemic goods, such as information and knowledge and truth and others among them. And I think of these rights as governing the quality, accessibility, and distribution of epistemic goods. And I think they play an increasingly prominent role in our lives and often go unnoticed and unprotected. So the more technical definition that I develop in chapter one of the book says that an epistemic right is a complex entitlement that provides justification for the performance and prohibition of actions and omissions concerning epistemic goods. Now, it's a, you know, relatively long definition, and so much of chapter one is spent pretty much unpacking every single word in that definition. And there's probably not time to go through each and every term. But as you say, like many rights theorists, I take my lead from the legal philosopher Wesley Hofeld, who was writing in the early 20th century and has had an incredible staying power, it seems to me. Yeah. And he identified these four different senses of the term right. So I imagine listeners may be familiar, but for anyone who isn't, he called those privileges, claims, powers, and immunities. And I think we can see those different senses of the term right in play in the case of epistemic rights, with a kind of simple example, which I also kind of go back to several times throughout the book. So I'll just present that now. Imagine that I'm being tested for diabetes by my doctor. Once I've been tested, I have a privileged right to know my blood sugar levels, and that just means that I've got no duty not to know them. But I've also got a claim right to know my blood sugar levels, which means, for example, that I have a right to, say, prevent my doctor from misinforming me about my blood sugar levels, and that my doctor has a duty to provide me with the accurate results. And then in addition, I've got a power right to waive my claim right and thereby not to know my blood sugar levels. I can just ask not to know them. And finally, I've got an immunity right, which protects me from my doctor taking away or altering my claim right to know my blood sugar levels. So of these four senses, the one I'm most interested in with respect to epistemic rights, and this also is following Hofeld, is claim rights. Claim rights are particularly important, I think, because they are social in essence. They involve other people because of the necessary relationship between claims and duties that you mentioned right at the start. You mm-hmm. can't have a claim right unless someone else has a duty to fulfill your claim like the doctor in that example. And that means that epistemic duties are central to understanding the nature of epistemic rights. And most importantly, as I think we'll probably discuss in a bit, they're important for understanding and identifying when epistemic rights have been violated. Right. So what makes a right an epistemic right? I mean, you're exactly right to kind of pick up on the point in the book where which I tried to stress and hopefully it comes through that what I want is to establish the kind of status of epistemic rights within the framework of rights theory, so that I'm not talking about sort of epistemic rights purely in the epistemic domain. In fact, I want epistemic rights in the sense that I'm talking about them to be understood as political and legal and moral rights. So that's not meant to be a kind of additional domain-specific set of rights, although it's possible that that set of rights already exists, and there is, you know, some work that might suggest that in contemporary epistemology. But my interest is in thinking about this as a distinct class of legal and moral rights, much like we think of property rights as a distinct class of legal and moral rights. And so what makes it a right, an epistemic right, is just simply the connection to epistemic goods, much like a property right is a property right because of the connection to property. So it's a kind of fairly simple way of understanding what epistemic rights are within the context of the broader landscape of rights theory. But I do some work in the book to distinguish that between a kind of notion of rights or entitlements within contemporary epistemology that is more restricted to the epistemic domain.
Right, fabulous. So that's very helpful. The next natural question, of course, then, right, is about the rights holders, the holders of epistemic rights. So here, again, sort of two interlinked questions. What are the conditions under which one or an entity can have epistemic rights? Who, in fact, has them?
Right. Yeah, exactly. This is a natural question in particular because of that framing, because really the answer to the first question, the simple answer is everyone can have epistemic rights. The conditions for being an epistemic right holder are, in essence, the conditions for being a right holder. And that's, I think, that's an important distinction in contrast to a position that I thought about a lot and, you know, developed arguments going back and forth around this idea, but that you have an epistemic right only if you can have an epistemic state, if you like, you can be in an epistemic state. So the relationship between epistemic rights and epistemic, what I call epistemic capacity, the ability to know, the ability to understand. So that raises some really interesting questions. It leads to a couple of interesting conclusions around who in general can have epistemic rights, including, for example, young children, infants and babies. I talk about that a little bit, and I conclude that babies, infants can have epistemic, and in fact do have epistemic rights in certain situations. People find that a slightly counterintuitive claim because it seems like odd to claim that a baby can have a right to know, for example, the results of a blood sugar test, when they don't have the capacity to know that. But in that case, it's actually useful to draw that case out a little because it highlights the nature of the rights themselves, which is that they are to actions rather than to goods or states, right? So the baby doesn't have a right to the good of knowledge itself. A baby has a right to the actions of the duty bearer in that case, so the actions of the doctor, say, taking a blood sugar test for a baby. And then we expect that a doctor performs as epistemically admirably in the case of babies than they do in the case of adults. And if they didn't, we would find serious wrong. And part of that wrong would be an epistemic wrong. The case of babies and infants, and it's also the case in, for example, the case of someone with in a long-term coma, they need epistemic proxies, so they need people that are going to stand in for them to defend their epistemic rights and to take on the knowledge or the information on the behalf of the individual. But for me, at least, it's really, really important that we don't strip away rights of any kind, including epistemic rights, from individuals on the basis of their capacity. So I talk a little bit about, for example, cognitive aging disorders are often associated with a kind of loss or change in epistemic capacity. And I don't want it to be the case, and I don't think it is the case, that one should sort of lose epistemic rights and the right to accurate information, the right to others bearing duties with respect to information that is important or significant to oneself on the basis of a loss of epistemic capacity. What it does mean is that people that are in that situation, and babies are on the other end of that scale, require epistemic proxies, which means we really need good systems and institutions that are going to uphold epistemic rights on the part of individuals who can't sort of protect and defend their own epistemic rights. So hopefully that gives a kind of sense of who can have them. And then, like you said, there's this kind of distinct question about who actually does have them, because while everyone can have epistemic rights, we don't all have the same epistemic rights. So what is it that makes it the case that I have a right to know, you know, the results of my blood sugar test, and you don't have that right? And so I unpack that a little bit in the chapter two. I talk about a right holder having an epistemic right when it is legally or morally permissible to enforce an epistemic duty. And this is where we start to see duties really like playing a central role in the theory and the analysis of epistemic rights. So a quick idea of epistemic duties, broadly speaking, an epistemic duty is simply a duty that concerns epistemic goods. So I explore that concept in a little bit more detail by looking at different types of epistemic duties. And here I draw inspiration for a basic taxonomy of epistemic duties from Article 19 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. So that's the article that says, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. So Article 19 is typically cited as the article concerning freedom of expression, which it is, of course. But the article, I think, interestingly covers more than a person's right to the free expression of ideas and opinions. It also highlights a person's rights to seek, receive, and impart information. And these are all epistemic rights, and I think they correlate with a basic taxonomy of epistemic duties, which are duties to seek, receive, and impart information. And I call that a basic taxonomy because it provides only a basic frame for the construction of a more complex and a more complete taxonomy of epistemic duties that might come in time. But I think it's nonetheless the frame around which a more complete taxonomy can be built. And in fact, that basic taxonomy of three epistemic duties can be immediately doubled to six by noticing that they each comprise both a positive and a negative duty. So the positive duties to seek, receive, and impart information, and the negative duties not to seek, not to receive, and not to impart information. So again, a right holder has an epistemic right when it is legally or morally permissible to enforce one of these epistemic duties. And I talk a little bit about the different ways in which that enforcement or the different forms of that enforcement can take.
Right. So can I ask a, this is a real philosopher's question, I'm sorry. you know, one of the questions that struck me as I was reading this part of the book, particularly with respect to the former of the two questions we were just discussing, who can have epistemic rights. You know, I think wisely in the book, you try to avert having to take a stance on the debate between will and interest theories in the rights literature.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm just wondering, you know, and this could be a very short answer because, you know, I'm just wondering if the kind of view you take about who can have epistemic rights might not push you in one direction on the will versus interest. It looks as if, you know, you might be edging towards an interest view of rights. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Or it doesn't look like you need to be able, if it doesn't look like you need to be able to be a claimant, then it looks like, you know, some element of the will theory is not on the cards, right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. And, you know, to some extent in the writing of the book, I spent quite a lot of time in the mires of the interester versus will theory debate. It's got a lot of complexity and a lot of contributions over the years. So,
you're being very tactful in saying it that way, by the way.
I mean, it's coming from a fascinating historical place, I think. It was sort of an interesting result for me that after quite a bit of time in the weeds, as it were, I ended up feeling that I didn't actually need to take a stance because whichever of those theories, if you're committed to one or the other, it shouldn't discount the possibility that epistemic rights exist. So they should be able to be accommodated by one or the other. Now, that being said, I spent probably a bit more time in the interest theory camp, and perhaps that is actually coming through, particularly with respect to that relationship between capacity and rights. So yes, there is, I think there's some truth in what you're saying. What I want to do is to allow for the discussion really to be taken up by others sense, and to see where the chips fall, because I think probably they might fall on the interest side, but I wasn't convinced enough in my own reasoning to actually commit in the book, and that's why I've sort of, and also I'm wanting this to be a theory that kind of transcends that debate to an extent. So
sure.
Yeah, but I think you're onto something there. We should talk about that more.
That's fabulous. So it's, you know, by the way, just traditionally, will theorists are going to have a hard time with some of the cases that with respect to rights, not strictly epistemic rights, but rights of any kind, mm-hmm. They're going to have a hard time and they do have a hard time sort of explaining pretty intuitive views about, it seems intuitive to talk about individuals being rights holders of various kinds, even when they don't have the capacity to make the claims.
Yeah.
And so, good. But let's move on. You know, this is a very system. I mean, this is a very tight work of philosophy, which means that it's also very systematic and stepwise in a way. So, you know, which makes it a real nice read. But it also means that, you know, so there's the obvious next question, right? So we've figured out what epistemic rights are, what makes a right an epistemic right, who can have them, who has them. And now I guess the next natural question is what it means for epistemic rights to be violated, and what does it mean for them to be protected?
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad it makes perfect sense to me that we follow this this systematic arc, which is the one I follow in a bit, because these questions kind of come naturally to me too. An epistemic right is violated, I think, when any epistemic duties, which we've just been talking about, resulting from that right to perform or not perform certain actions, are unjustifiably disregarded. So putting that into the context of the blood sugar example, I've got a right to know my blood sugar levels after being tested for diabetes. And if my doctor misinforms me about them for no good reason, and it's pretty hard to imagine what a good reason would be, then she unjustifiably disregards her duty to provide me with accurate results, and so she violates my right. So I think epistemic rights can be violated in many, many, many different ways. But I think it'd be interesting to look at how that kind of pans out in the world around us. And for that, I'll take us back to the Purdue Pharma case. So if you remember that in 2007, the Purdue Frederick Company, Inc., along with its president, chief legal officer, and chief medical officer, were charged with criminal misbranding of the opioid OxyContin after admitting that the drug was marketed, in quotes, with the intent to defraud or mislead, end quote. So Purdue consistently and systematically distorted information about OxyContin, including with respect to its effectiveness, abusability, and addictive properties. And as such, the company and its executives unjustifiably disregarded their epistemic duties, and in doing so, violated their customers' and clients' epistemic rights. So I think that several prominent forms of epistemic rights violations can be drawn out from that case. Firstly, Purdue knowingly propagated falsehoods about the safety profile of OxyContin in order to convince medical professionals that it was safer than other opioids on the market. So, for example, they instructed sales representatives to tell doctors that the risk of addiction from the drug is less than 1%, when in fact it's much higher. A lawyer, Paul Hanley, in 2003 attempted to bring a criminal trial against Purdue, which was ultimately settled outside of court. And he wrote in a statement following that, this is a quote again, "These pronouncements about how safe the drug was emanated from the marketing department, not the scientific department. They just made this stuff up." So Purdue knowingly propagated falsehoods regarding the safety profile of OxyContin, and in doing so, they unjustifiably disregarded their epistemic duty. And I think that duty correlates with the epistemic rights of their customers to accurate information about the safety profile of OxyContin. And the propagation of falsehoods is a common form of epistemic rights violation. And then secondly, as well as propagating outright falsehoods, Purdue engaged in extensive misinformation regarding various aspects of OxyContin. For example, a key original selling point of OxyContin over other opioids was the time-release formula that would allow patients to take the painkiller every 12 hours instead of every 8 hours, which was more common. And that would make dosages easier to adhere to because, you know, you're not getting up in the night or what have you. So Purdue was aware while issuing that claim that not all patients would respond to the timely release formula in the same way. And in particular, an early study of OxyContin users in Puerto Rico showed that approximately half of the patients taking the drug required further doses between before the 12-hour time interval. So there were three LA Times journalists that were behind a 2016 expose highlighted the damage that could be caused by that improper dosage. And this is another quote from that expose. "OxyContin is a chemical cousin of heroin, and when it doesn't last, patients can experience excruciating symptoms of withdrawal, including an intense craving for the drug." So nonetheless, Pergy pushed that 12-hour time release formula as a key selling point, misleading both doctors and patients into believing that two doses at 12-hour intervals would be effective for all. So it's a kind of a case of knowingly propagating misinformation about the effectiveness of a key element of OxyContin. And that propagation of misinformation is another common form of epistemic rights violation. Thirdly, propagation of misinformation often relies heavily on a policy of withholding information, which has the effect of distorting one's assessment of the information or the misinformation that's actually made available. So Pergy knowingly withheld some vital information about OxyContin from the outset. So that Puerto Rican study that I mentioned, they never published it, and various evidence that was also demonstrating that issue, as well as complaints from prescribing doctors, were similarly ignored and suppressed. And therefore, they were knowingly withholding information about the effectiveness of the time release formula, and again, unjustifiably disregarding their epistemic duty. So then a kind of fourth and I think interesting additional rights violation that we can see in this case was the failure of Pergy to take the results of the study seriously and act accordingly. They failed to take seriously the results of multiple further studies and warnings from numerous other key individuals, including the Food and Drugs Administration. So clear evidence from multiple studies that OxyContin is required at shorter than 12-hour intervals for many patients was simply ignored, and they also failed to run any studies testing the effectiveness of OxyContin at the shorter time intervals, because obviously that would have undermined their competitive advantage. But by failing to conduct those studies, Pergy unjustifiably disregarded their epistemic duty to seek out vital information about the safety profile and addictive properties of OxyContin. So that's another epistemic rights violation that correlates with one of those sort of negative epistemic duties that I mentioned earlier. And then I don't know if there's time, but there's a final kind of widespread form of epistemic rights violation that I just want to highlight, which is what I call the abuse of perceived epistemic authority. So I think of this as made possible in any situation where an individual or organization is perceived as an epistemic authority on a given subject. So in other words, where they are perceived as a source of accurate, reliable, and relevant information. So the abuse of perceived epistemic authority is made possible by perceived rather than actual epistemic authority. So regardless of whether someone actually has the information or is in fact an authority. And of course, Pergy Pharma, as a major global producer of pharmaceuticals, can reasonably be perceived as a source of accurate, reliable, and relevant information about its own pharmaceutical products, particularly if we've got no knowledge of, for example, the misinformation practices that they systematically employed. So a doctor who's not aware of those practices and is told by a Pergy salesperson that OxyContin has an effective 12-hour time-release formula and a risk of addiction at less than 1% might reasonably and blamelessly form the corresponding false beliefs and prescribe OxyContin on this basis. And like you mentioned earlier, Bob, her patients, being one step further removed, can perceive the doctor as an epistemic authority on which drugs they should take to relieve pain. So the patient can reasonably and blamelessly inherit the doctor's false beliefs regarding OxyContin and act on the basis of those beliefs. So you kind of have two layers of epistemic authority in the way of getting to the truth about what you should do with respect to the a question as important as what drug you should take to relieve pain. So I think of the abuse of perceived epistemic authority as a particularly pernicious form of epistemic rights violation, especially when over epistemic power dynamics are in play, because a person is obviously more likely to believe information on a given subject when it comes from a source that they perceive to be an epistemic authority. And that can lead to a kind of credibility excess, whereby unwarranted credibility is given to information from a perceived epistemic authority, even though it's in fact false or misleading. And so doctors and patients at the sharp end of Purdue's manipulative and misleading sales and marketing practices are not only at risk of receiving false, misleading and incomplete information about OxyContin, they're also at risk of assigning unwarranted credibility to that information as a result of the abuse of perceived epistemic authority. That's the kind of suite, in a way, of just some of the most prominent and, I think, pernicious forms of epistemic rights violations that we can identify in so many different situations, but which come out all in a neat package in the Purdue Pharma case.
Right. And one quick question. Do you think, again, just I don't know why, what it suggests about me that in the pharma case, I'm thinking about the way that doctors are rendered complicit. I could just imagine a physician sort of having trusted the Purdue Pharma rep, following what ordinarily would be sort of proper epistemic scruples, and prescribing this drug all in good faith, only to find that he had been duped, and the way he had been duped sort of renders him or her complicit in ruining another person's life, right? Yeah. That there's maybe that's not strictly epistemic, but it does seem to me to be part of the. Part of the abuse of the authority or the perceived authority has to do with the ability to sort of make others do your bidding.
Right, exactly. And I think that's a really kind of crucial point about the relationship between, and this is a relationship that is being explored, in much, much more depth and wide-ranging cases in epistemology these days, but the relationship between, epistemic states and goods and power, really, and right. Just how much power you can accrue by manipulating someone's belief system by doing any one of the number of things that I've talked about or any other kind of manipulation of information. I think that's a really important and interesting way to frame that significant point, which is that, when we mess with beliefs and belief systems, we exert a type of power and influence that often goes unnoticed and is entirely underregulated, in my opinion, particularly, for example, in that case, and yet causes serious harm.
Right. So in the interest of time, I want to get to sort of at least two more things. One is sort of both of which sort of come quickly on the heels of the analysis of epistemic rights violations. One has to do with your analysis of the harms that the violations produce, or the harms that are constitutive of the violations. The second sort of closely is how epistemic rights are or can be protected. So why don't I sort of ask you to sort of address those two, what seem to me to be pretty closely related parts of your analysis together. What are the harms that we're talking about in epistemic rights violations, and how then can the rights be protected?
Yeah, great. So like you say, I talk about harms in the book. In chapter four, it's really all about trying to give a kind of taxonomy almost of the different harms, and many, many and too many to mention. Yeah. In a kind of broad overview, I talk about a distinction between primary and secondary harms, which I take from Miranda Fricker and epistemic injustice. And I talk about kind of primary harms being integral to the wrong of the epistemic rights violation. It's kind of what makes it wrong to violate someone's epistemic rights. And I think of those in two forms, one which I call epistemic injury, and one which I call epistemic insult. Epistemic injury can be kind of broadly thought of as injuring someone's epistemic system, if you like, giving them false information, giving them misleading information, making them believe, manipulating them into a state where they believe something incorrectly and or withholding information. Kind of almost, I think there's a close analogy, which is why I use injury, to a physical harm, that your epistemic system is kind of disrupted and harmed in some way that causes an injury to the system itself and to your belief system itself. And then epistemic insult is a kind of form of primary harm that attaches to that injury. And I think is perhaps particularly an issue in the case of abusive perceived epistemic authority, for example. And so I think you can harm individuals in these ways, and you can harm communities in these ways. And then there's a whole series of secondary harms that I talk about. And I kind of at this point draw on all the different real world cases that I've looked at throughout the book, which I think illustrate the nature and extent of violations and harms. So those cases range across a wide variety of public and private domains, from rights surrounding, say, freedom of information and state-sponsored mass surveillance, to rights concerning the risks of abortion or of sexually transmitted diseases. I talk in quite a bit of detail about the case of AIDS denialism. Talk about the rights of factory workers to know what harmful chemicals they're exposed to, or adopted children to know who their biological parents are. These are all kind of versions of epistemic rights that are, to a greater and lesser degree, already protected in legal systems, but that result in, when the violations take place, result in a series of both primary and secondary harms, which may be epistemic or might well just be practical harms. Things like, being misled into believing that smoking isn't bad for your lungs in the 50s and 60s, huge, equivalent kind of types of campaigning to the Purdue Pharma case from the tobacco industry. Right. That leads people to consume cigarettes in a way that they might not have done otherwise, on the basis of the belief that it's not harmful, and thereby they end up with serious, potentially fatal harm, physical harm, psychological harm of, for example, addiction, clearly brings with it psychological harms that can be caused as a result of a faulty belief system, like in the Purdue Pharma case, and also emotional, sexual, and I think financial harms are all in the pot, basically, when it comes to the harms that are caused by epistemic rights violations. Basically, name a harm, and it can be the result of an epistemic rights violation. And hopefully in the book, I give a clear sense of quite how widespread I think those harms can be. So in terms of protecting them, I talk about different types of legal protections, direct legal protections, which are out there. And there are some direct legal protections, increasing direct legal protections of epistemic rights, where we take, the defense of a person's epistemic state to be the actual subject of the legal, of the law. In many more cases, I think there are indirect legal protections of epistemic rights. And in that case, I think there's a good reason to ask a question, well, should these indirect protections become direct protections? In other words, should we draw out the epistemic element of this legal, this law, say, and actually treat it as something autonomous in its own right, and establish a case for protecting that thing in and of itself? So, for example, the case of knowing what has happened in a response to a human rights atrocity, there are tragic number of people who, for example, just don't know what has happened to loved ones. And I think there's a really, really good case to be made for not simply regarding that right to know what has happened to loved ones as a sort of subservient to a general procedural justice right, but actually an autonomous right in and of itself. Those people have the right to know, and not knowing is a source of genuine both primary and secondary harm. So I think there are some protections. I think the legal protections could be much, much, much more substantive and wide-ranging. There are also moral kind of but not legal protections where we hold people to account through blaming practices, public shaming practices, and so on. Purdue has been at the end of some of those moral blame practices. And I think, you know, that not all rights need to be protected by legal frameworks, but there are good questions to ask around whether some of those moral rights that we protect only morally could be protected legally. So that's a kind of broad overview. Hopefully it gives sense.
Very good. So you've been very generous with your time. And so I wanted to just make sure that in the minutes we have remaining, just to ask a question about the second bit of the subtitle of the book, the why we need them. So, you know, I suppose that listeners of a certain age will remember a time, in my view, a not very happy time in political philosophy, where a lot of theorists were very, expressed concerns about rights and talk, particularly about talk about rights. That the thought was that when our social relations are, you know, seen as the kind of things that are regulated by rights talk, we've given up on something important about community and human relations and all the rest. Now, one strand, a popular strand of that view, saw one of the vulnerabilities of rights talk. Is that it, it tended to proliferate, that more and more, once we start thinking in terms of rights, once we start thinking about our relations in terms of rights, you know, more and more things become governable by rights or analyzable in terms of rights rather than other kinds of moral registers. So you think we need epistemic rights, by the way, you've convinced me, but can you, for what it's worth, can you tell me a little bit about the why we need them, why we need to think of the epistemic goods that your analysis of rights is sort of targeted at, why they are the kinds of goods that are best pursued and protected and secured by way of a theory of epistemic rights?
Yeah. Yeah, great. So I guess in some sense that subtitle is really almost designed as a kind of, you know, an indication that I'm aware that there's, you know, there is a kind of potential concern about the language of rights and about characterizing things as rights and proliferating rights. And therefore, the book in itself is intended to stand as a kind of answer to the question of why, in this case, and certainly not in all cases, but in this case, we should be using the language of rights. And I think there's, I guess, three kind of reasons why I think, firstly, three reasons why I think we should highlight the epistemic dimension and treat it as constituting a fully fledged right in and of itself. Because, of course, some of these rights I've talked about, patient rights, for example, my right to know my blood sugar levels is protected already by me being a patient. But I think we should be treating the epistemic dimension of that right as a right in and of itself. So it's really about identifying epistemic rights as a distinct and unified class of rights. And firstly, I think treating epistemic rights in this way effectively names and identifies a feature of our moral landscape. It allows us to more accurately describe and better understand something which I think is very important and very much contained within and influencing our, you know, moral actions, our moral behavior, as well as our legal frameworks. So I think it simply allows us to name it and see it. I think it, in doing so, it allows us to identify previously unrecognized and underappreciated harms. And it puts us in a better position to detect new potential harms in the epistemic domain. And thirdly, I think it allows for the design of more effective protections against those harms in the form of education, regulation, and legislation, just identifying epistemic rights violations and the harms that are caused by them can allow us to start to regulate and start to legislate where we think that doing so is going to protect individuals. But I think the deeper question that you're asking and that, you know, is important to address is around really why appeal to the language of rights at all? Why draw on the notion of rights and duties to expose and articulate these epistemic wrongs and harms? What's the language of rights adding? And again, in the first place, I think there's a simple answer, and that's the one that I do try to emphasize throughout the book, which is just that epistemic rights are rights in the broad sense, in the sense that we think of moral, political, and legal rights. So as such, the language of rights is the only language that actually does the job of accurately describing the phenomenon that I'm interested in. But obviously, it's not without its critics. And so I think there are three good reasons for employing the language of rights beyond the simple fact that it's accurate. So firstly, rights allow for the direction of conduct in a unique and consistent way. They prescribe what we and others can and cannot do because, like I mentioned earlier, they attach to actions, not to objects, right? So it's all about essentially determining how we should act in regard of epistemic goods. And that's a really unique feature of rights talk, contrasted with other types of moral terms that I think is really worth paying attention to for epistemologists in particular. And then secondly, rights constitute a basis and a mechanism for holding those responsible for harms and wrongs to account on both legal and moral grounds. So those protections that I talked about, as soon as we deploy the language of rights in relation to epistemic goods, we have an immediate familiarity with how to advocate for them, how to, you know, do epistemic activism in defense of our rights, how to create legal bases for defending and protecting our rights, and so on. And thirdly, the language of rights, I think, for some of these reasons, has a distinctive rhetorical force that, when we use it appropriately, is invaluable for the advancement and protection of ourselves and our communities. And we've seen that through rights activism, you know, over the last, you know, 50 to 100 years. It's been an important feature of the social and moral progress that we've made. That's absolutely not to say that it's not got issues. There are not problems with rights talk. There definitely are. But in my view, and I follow Glendon and Glendon on that thinking, that it doesn't mean we should abandon talk of rights. It means we should get much better at identifying them, much better at articulating them, much better at defending and protecting them in legal context. And that's why I think it's really important that we do the work of thinking through epistemic harms and wrongs with the framework of rights in place.
That's totally convincing to me. So I don't know if that makes it a good answer, but it sounds to me like the right kind of answer. But maybe I'm an easy audience for that. So Lanny, you know, just thank you so much for joining me and for talking with me about your book.
Thank you.
Thanks, listener, for tuning in to New Books in Philosophy. We've been talking about Lanny Watson's new book, which is called The Right to Know, Epistemic Rights and Why We Need Them. It's just been published with Routledge. It's really fabulous, and I encourage you to take a look. But for now, thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy. Bye-bye.